Welcome back to the program. It's not too often that events that happened 33 years ago are remembered as if they were yesterday. When this does happen, it's usually because of both the enormity of the event as well as some deeper resonance inherent in that event. Such was the case with the massacre of 1,000 people in Jonestown on November 18, 1978. What perplexes us to this very day is how so many people and such a wide and diverse group can be taken in by one demagogue. And beyond that, how can a man who was once a darling of San Francisco liberals and a human rights activist become so deranged? In understanding this, perhaps we'll have a keener insight into both the human need to belong and to individual psychopathology. We're going to talk about Jonestown today with my guest, Julia Shears. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Jesus Land. It is my pleasure to welcome Julia Shears back to this program to talk about 1,000 Lives, the untold story of hope, deception, and survival at Jonestown. Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. This is still regarded as sort of the greatest mass suicide of modern times.
That's correct. And that is an incorrect perception. The central argument of my book was that these people were murdered. It wasn't mass suicide, as Jones wanted the world to believe.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about Jones and where he came from. He was a different guy, really, in the 50s as he was in the 60s than he was in the 70s.
That's right. You know, he started out in Indiana, in a small town, basically as a street preacher when he was a teenager. He would go into the black sections of Richmond, Indiana, stand on the street and talk about, use Bible verses and talk about how there should be equality. And he quickly attracted a African-American audience who wanted to hear what this charismatic teenager had to say. And I believe, and I would posit, that is how he found his followers. He realized that there were a lot of African Americans who were unhappy with the civil rights movement, that it hadn't gone far enough, and that he was going to take it further by integrating his church and creating this movement in Indiana and then ultimately in San Francisco of equality for racial equality, gender equality, all of the, to create a perfect society, basically.
Mm-hmm. And talk about his time in California, really in the 60s, the influence that the Black Panthers had on him, and his perception, the public perception of him as kind of a human rights activist almost.
Well, that's one thing people have forgotten after Jonestown, is that when Jim Jones was in San Francisco leading this giant, you know, integrated church, kind of like Glide, if you're familiar with Glide.
Sure.
They did a lot of outreach. They had soup kitchens. They had medical clinics for impoverished elderly African-Americans. They had daycare for single mothers. They helped people get off drugs. I mean, they were doing a lot of good, and he was really putting himself out there as this do-gooder who is going to help the underdog. He won friends in high places. You know, Willie Brown was a supporter. Jane Fonda was a supporter. People tend to forget that. In his heyday, he was a political kingmaker. He got George Moscone elected. He got Freitas elected, the district attorney. People came to his church, politicians came to his church seeking his endorsement. And in exchange, he would send out this fleet of workers to canvass neighborhoods, to populate demonstrations, to cast their ballots in other districts even. I mean, he really had power in numbers back in his heyday.
When did the cracks begin to appear? When did it become clear that something was amiss?
Well, things were amiss, you know, early on. And if you read through the paper trail, you can see that Jim Jones was not okay from his personal notes. I mean, I found in this trove of recently released FBI documents, for example, he wrote a note to a man who left his church in Indianapolis saying that he better rejoin the church or else, like threatening that something bad would happen to him and that he loved him so much he would be heartbroken if something bad happened to him, but that it was the will of God for him to be in his church. Jim Jones had this pathological fear of abandonment and of people speaking out against him. So in order to control his followers, he was doing all kinds of weird things behind closed doors. He was having them sign false confessions. He was having them sign blank pieces of paper. He was having these meetings where the members were spanked with a board. All of these things, you know, then no one was allowed to talk about. So to the outsider, it looked like this happy, integrated, huge throng, this movement. But internally, Jones kept a really tight grip on his followers. And ultimately, that began to leak out. There were a couple of nosy reporters that came to visit the church, including Consulting, I forget his name, Les Consulting, mm-hmm. and a Chronicle reporter. And they started seeing that there must be something behind the song and dance, the charade. And sure enough, former members started to come forward and talk about some of the things that Jim Jones was doing inside the church that no one knew about.
You mentioned this treasure trove of material, some 50,000 pages of documents. Talk a little about that, Julia.
Sure. So what happened was, you know, the last days in Jonestown, what happened was Congressman Leo Ryan from San Mateo decided to go to Jonestown and investigate claims that people were being held against their will. So he went down there, visited Jonestown, and as he was leaving, a group of residents said, "We want to go with you. We're scared. We want to get out of here." And then Jones knew the gig was up. He had been keeping things under wraps in Jonestown. No reporters were allowed in. The people weren't allowed to communicate with the outside world and tell, you know, the world that they were being underfed, that they weren't getting enough sleep, that Jones was having these suicide rehearsals about really the dire conditions of Jonestown. So Jones knew when those defectors left with Ryan that day that the gig was up. So he sent a group of henchmen to the airstrip as Congressman Ryan and the departing party was waiting for their plane and gunned them down and killed five of these people. So after the congressman was killed, the only congressman assassinated in office, it became a federal investigation. So the FBI went into Jonestown to try and figure out what the heck had happened. Who were these people? Why did they kill the congressman? And in doing so, as part of their investigation, they picked up every single piece of paper that they could get from the mud of Jonestown after the massacre. And this trove of information, about 50,000 pieces of paper, included everything from crop reports to meeting notes to diaries to letters that were never sent home to many notes to Jim Jones saying, "I am miserable here and I want to go home. I had no idea it was going to be like this. My child is having nightmares. Please let me go back to California." So these pieces of paper tell the true story of what happened in Jonestown, and I'm hoping that they change the perception of the public that what happened ultimately the last night in Jonestown was not a mass suicide, but it was a well-orchestrated and methodically planned murder by Jim Jones.
In talking about the planning for it, much of the cyanide, much of the drugs that were involved were things that he had been importing down there for a long time.
Well, what happened was he basically 2 months after he got there, he was already telling the people to prepare to commit mass suicide. And this is in September of 1977, okay, over a year before the end of Jonestown, which was November of 78. He was already telling them, look, someday we may have to commit, quote-unquote, revolutionary suicide. And he would hold these votes in Jonestown at night, and almost every night, who's in favor of revolutionary suicide? Raise your hand. And if you didn't raise your hand, a security guard would come and nuzzle you with a gun and have you stand before Jim Jones, or he would berate you, and the meeting would go on for hours. And finally, it got to the point where people were like, okay, I'll raise my hand so I can get to bed. I'm exhausted. I have to get up at 6 the next morning and work in the fields. My children are here. They need sleep. So it got to the point where, you know, despite their own wishes to live, and at the very beginning they would argue with Jones and saying, no, we want to fight for our community. We didn't come down here to die. We came down here to live. We came down here to create a better society for our kids. So despite the idealism of those settlers, when they landed in Jonestown, Jim Jones gradually just cowed them and had this kind of psychological warfare where he would keep them up late at night arguing that they would need to commit revolutionary suicide. They would need to commit mass suicide to protest capitalism. And, you know, ultimately people would just raise their hand. Okay, yeah, whatever, let's just go back to bed, never really believing that he would do it.
And this notion of revolutionary suicide really came from a lot of Black Panther rhetoric, Huey Newton specifically.
It came from Huey Newton. Huey Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panthers, wrote an autobiography called Revolutionary Suicide. But what he meant by the term was that a black man, if he's being attacked by the forces of oppression, should go down swinging. He shouldn't passively die. But if a cop is coming at him shooting, you know, he should go down swinging, you know, not to be passive, but to push back. And so Jones completely twisted this notion into we should all die for socialism. You know, that was his cause, socialism. And it wasn't about going down swinging as, you know, you're being overrun by cops. It was about this methodical planning of killing almost 1,000 people in the jungle. And one of the subtexts of the book is that they couldn't figure out how to pull it off, how to kill everyone. You know, so they had these meetings where they were talking about mass suicide. And then early in January of 78, he's directing his medical department to figure out how to kill everyone because they don't have enough bullets. And so I found all of these notes from the medical department, the nurse, the medical director, the dietitian, suggesting various colorful ways of killing the community. And ultimately, the camp doctor, Larry Schacht, set up this laboratory where he was growing cultures of botulism and staphylococci and trying to create a bacterial way to kill everyone. He wasn't successful, and then he thought, well, how about cyanide?
Were there times that people tried to leave prior to 1978?
There were. You know, in particular, I follow five people through Jonestown. This is the structure of the book. It's kind of a gentler way in for the reader. You can learn about why these five people were attracted to Jim Jones and ended up in Jonestown. And one person in particular I follow is a Tommy Bogue, who was 15 when he was sent down to Jonestown, and he was miserable there. First, he loved it. Before Jim Jones was there, he loved it. You know, he was running around the jungle. He had a pal who was Amerindian who, you know, they would run around the bush together looking at weird animals and, you know, having adventure, being boys, being kids. And then once Jones got down there and really started beating the drum that someday they'd all have to die for socialism, he got scared, and he and another teenager ran away. And that's one instance. And, you know, I found this paper trail of, you know, information about his running away, as well as an audio tape of Jim Jones confronting the boys just after they were caught by the Jonestown security crew and brought before the entire community. And, you know, listening to this tape, even at 33 years removed, is just an incredible gut-wrenching experience. You know, you can feel as if you were that 15-year-old boy, and the leader is just angry and berating you, and they're ultimately discussing whether these two kids should be killed for trying to run away, and who's going to kill them, and how they should kill them. I mean, it's surreal.
How large an army, really, did Jones have down there in the jungles of Guyana?
Well, he had security, and I think ultimately they recovered some 30-some guns from Jonestown that had been smuggled from San Francisco. So one of the members of Jim Jones' church was a probation officer here in California who was in charge of smuggling guns to Jonestown. And she would buy these guns and send Jim Jones memos about what she had purchased. You know, it was in code. I was able to figure out what the code was. And then they sent these guns down in false bottom crates that were built in the back parking lot of the church on Geary Street. And ultimately, you know, after the massacre, they discovered how it was done. But these guns were ultimately used that last night as Jim Jones was telling everybody to line up and drink this poison punch. The security guards with guns, one ring had guns, one ring had those arrows, what are they called, Bowie arrows?
Mm-hmm.
Pointed at the people saying, you know, drink or else you're going to be gunned down or you're going to be shot with an arrow. They didn't have any choice. So it was really interesting. Even though he didn't have this large security contingent, you know, he had enough guns to intimidate, and ultimately that last night to force people to drink cyanide and
Given how many people that there were, obviously we know that there were approximately 1,000 people, why was there not more of an attempt to overpower Jones's people?
You know, that's a good question. He held a drink drill prior to November in May after one of his top leaders defected, where he lined everybody up and had them drink what was basically unsugared Kool-Aid. And so he did that, and he said afterwards, you know, when they figured out that they weren't actually dying, that he wanted to test their loyalty to him. So I think ultimately that last night, a lot of people, you know, they were to the end doubting that this man who said that he loved them and he was the only person who truly cared about them and only wanted good for them and their children would do this, which would kill them. I mean, there was the shock element. There were the people, the men facing them with guns. There was also the doubt whether this was just another drill or was this really happening. And so, you know, one thing Jim Jones did was he taped himself. Whenever he had made a public address, he would tape himself. And so the FBI also recovered some 971 tapes from Jonestown, including a tape of the last night of the suicide ritual. And you can hear on the tape, you know, at first the crowd is, you know, the babies are giggling and, you know, you can hear the kids in the background. And then once people realize that people are actually dying, there's screams and cries and people shouting no. It's just, it's beyond belief. I've only been able to listen to the tape twice. But that tape really is evidence that these people were murdered. And we also have eyewitness accounts that people who went, they would go through the line, get up to the vat of poisoned punch, turn around and walk back to their seats. And so the nurses started then going around with syringes full of the poison and just injecting people on their bodies wherever they could and leaving them to die alone. It was a horrific event.
Is there evidence that Jones became crazier, more demonic during the 4 years there in Guyana?
There is. He was abusing drugs heavily, and he became more paranoid. He already had a little bit of a paranoid complex, and at first he kind of used this kind of the siege mentality that we are a special people and there are forces out there who want to destroy us, and so we have to knuckle down, and we need unswerving obedience from our members. He kind of used that siege mentality to his benefit all the way through his movement. But in Guyana, I think he really started to believe people were out to get him. He used a lot of drugs, and towards the end, he rarely even emerged from his cottage. And when he did emerge, he was usually, you know, being helped by two aides who were helping him walk. He slurred his words over the public address system. He had to sound words out. And his rants are incomprehensible at times. You know, he's talking about being dropped off of another planet, about, you know, really, really strange things. So, yes, there is evidence that his drug abuse and his paranoia got worse. And towards the end, he was not, like I said, he wasn't leaving his cabin, but he also had two guards posted outside of his cabin because he was afraid that his own people, the other residents in Jonestown, would try to kill him.
To what extent did the death of Ryan set in motion these final events, and were it not for that, how might have it played out there?
Well, Ryan's death enabled him to say, when the security guards got back to Jonestown that night, he was able to say, you know, all for one, one for all. One of our members has killed Ryan, essentially, has enacted this massacre on the airstrip. So now we're not going to give him up. We're all going to have to go down with him. Because any moment he was lying, the Guyanese army is going to come in and start torturing our children and kill us. So it's better just to take this potion that's going to gently let us fall asleep and go past to the other side. He told them about that he believed in reincarnation. So he kind of set that up for months. And one interesting thing was that he was importing the cyanide and figuring out the death plan once before Ryan came down there. So Ryan was basically just the touchstone. Okay, now we have a reason, quote unquote, to enact the mass suicide.
Had enough time gone by, though, would there have been more people that would have tried to leave?
Well, you know, the thing is that Jonestown is so completely isolated.
Mm-hmm.
It is so amazingly isolated. I was down there in 2008, and there's no road to Jonestown. Back in the 70s, when the People's Temple members were going there, they were taking a two-day journey by boat. That was the way in. Or, you know, for a lot of money, they could charter a plane from Georgetown. So what happened was, you know, they took this two-day boat journey into Jonestown, and once they got there, Jones promptly confiscated their passports and money and said, nope, you're not going home. You don't like it? Too bad. If people complained about Jonestown, even about the intense heat, which I felt, they would be in trouble. And he devised all kinds of methods for controlling people in Jonestown, the most notorious being, you know, shooting them up with Thorazine in the special care unit, as it was called. So, really, he developed this community where, you know, people weren't even allowed to complain about the heat or the food or the fact that they weren't getting enough sleep. They weren't allowed to complain, period. And he had them rehearsing questions or answers to questions in case journalists came in, you know. And this is a great thing that the FBI recovered, too, from Jonestown, were these tapes of Jones leading the community in questions that reporters might ask. So what kind of food do you have here? Well, we eat pork and chicken and steak, and it was all lies. They weren't eating meat at the end. And the people who survived Jonestown came out of the jungle having lost 30, 40 pounds. I mean, just incredible. They were completely weak. They were mentally, they thought that the jungle was full of mercenaries that were about to attack them and full of wild animals that would kill them if the mercenaries didn't. Jones really kind of set up this perfect hell that was people were unable to escape from.
I want to come back to this large misconception about this being a mass suicide.
Right.
And in part, that came about because of the last message that Jim Jones recorded.
Right, that the last message. But if you listen, that's the same tape we're talking about called the death tape,
right.
Which can easily be found online. And if you have the stomach to listen to it, as I said, well, first of all, I should mention the tape is heavily edited. Jim Jones had the tape recorder sitting beside him on his chair on the platform in which he sat, and he would start and stop the tape when it pleased him. So if somebody was saying something he didn't want to be heard for posterity, he would just pause the tape, and then he would start again when he was talking. So that tape is edited about 30-some times. And there is one voice, however, that stands out, and that is of this woman from Brownsville, Texas, named Christine Miller, who says, "I believe we all deserve to find our own destiny, that we deserve to live, that the children deserve to live." And Jones argues with her, and ultimately she is shouted down by some of the true believers, the people who believe there are actually mercenaries in the jungle that are about to come in and kill them. So if you listen to that tape and you take into consideration, you know, the materials that the FBI collected about all of these people that were unhappy and wanted to leave, but were able to publicly criticize Jones. And then Jones is like, you know what, stop writing me notes about being unhappy here. I don't care. No one is going home. You know, at one point he says, I don't care. If you want to go home, you can swim home. We won't pay your beep. Way home. If you take all of this evidence together, it is clear that what he orchestrated was mass murder, not mass suicide.
Then why is it that for so long there is this, has been this perception of to this day, of this still
right.
being a mass suicide?
Because people haven't been able to read through this evidence that the FBI collected from Jonestown until recently. I think one scholar, researcher, and I are the only ones who have read through the entire massive information they gathered. It took me a year to read through and organize this information. And then talking to survivors about what the experience was like. I think in another issue that you deal with, it's that the massacre was just so repulsive to so many people. I mean, a third of those who died were children. That they couldn't wrap their heads around it. The survivors came back to San Francisco, gathered in their church, and there were people outside yelling at them and calling them baby killers and saying that they should die as well, not understanding what happened. I think now, hopefully, if people read my book, they'll have a better understanding of how Jim Jones was able to orchestrate that last night of November 18, 1978, and hopefully people will change their perceptions about his victims. That they weren't psychotic Kool-Aid drinkers, as one historian recently called them, but that they were completely trapped and isolated and desperate and didn't know any better. Jones was their only source of information, and he was telling them that they were about to be invaded by these mercenaries and tortured and killed, and it was easier just to take this drink and fall asleep than it would be to face this phantom invader, which we know didn't exist.
Were there any common threads that you found among the people that were Jones's followers, among the people that chose to go there?
I think the biggest thread would be, you know, they were idealists. You know, they thought they were going to Jonestown, and in the beginning, they were excited. They thought that they were partaking in this great social experiment. They were going to create this society where there would be no racism or sexism or classism or elitism. They were going to a virgin jungle to create this utopia. That's their mentality as they were flying down to Guyana. And Jones had been sending back these videos and photos of how beautiful, you know, the nature was, and showing them the children of the early settlers playing, and it all looked so happy and welcoming. And then once they got there, of course, they realized that it was very different, in that they weren't getting enough to eat. They weren't getting enough to, you know, enough sleep. They weren't able to live, as Joan promised them, with their families, but they were all split up, and the family unit was broken down. They were unhappy, and then too late, they realized that Jones wasn't going to let them come back home.
And Jones finally shot himself. He didn't drink the cyanide, but actually shot himself.
You're right. I think he was a coward. I think he saw how agonizing, despite his, you know, trying to tell the crowd that last night that, you know, the children were crying because the liquid was a little bitter tasting. I think death by cyanide was an agonizing death, and after witnessing it, that he didn't want to go through that himself.
Julia Shears, the book is 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Julia, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me on.